Hello and welcome to Rhizone, the Horticulture Leaders Podcast. I'm William Clausen. I had the opportunity to sit down with Dave Van Bell from Van Bell Nurseries, and we had a fascinating conversation around company culture and open book management. We talked about attracting talent and the role that innovation plays in the horticulture business. Here's my conversation with Dave. Hello, Dave. Thanks for joining me.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, welcome to the Rhizone studio. I've just been kind of reflecting on that short intro chat that we had over the phone the other day just to get acquainted a little bit. And I'm definitely looking forward to our conversation just about what I've heard about you, what I've heard about the company. So Van Bell, who is Van Bell?
Well, it's a family nursery business. My parents started that in 1973. And my dad came west with me in a little box, and he just came to Abbotsford and he thought, hey, I'll start here. And he just started a lifestyle business. So it just became just a growing plants on the side to support a landscaping job he had. And then today, now we have really three main areas of focus in our company. And one of them is young plants. So we supply flowering shrubs to growers all across North America. The other division is called, we call finished plants. And that supplies box stores, typically in Western Canada. And then we supply it as much as we can. We want to be a one-stop shop for our customers. So shrubs, perennials, tropicals, trees, annuals. And then our third area of focus is our plant brand called Bloom and Easy. And Bloom and Easy is a consumer brand that we've started in response to helping our industry also become more profitable and more relevant to consumers' lives. And so all those three divisions, they work really well synergistically. So yeah, it's been kind of a fun business, and I've grown up in it, fortunately or unfortunately. Most of the time it's been good, and yeah, my parents are still around. They're not as involved on a daily basis, actually, but it's nice to have them here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, awesome. So you said you joined in 1995?
Yep. So I graduated from college in 1994, and I didn't know what to do. So I went and talked to one of my professors. He said, well, why don't you come back for a fifth year? And so I thought, you know, I'll do that. And I ended up getting two extra degrees out of it, out of that final year. And I ended up marrying my wife, which was also maybe a bit of a pull. And also I didn't know what I wanted to do. So after I graduated in 1994, I went back for a fifth year. Then after that fifth year, I came to the nursery, and I was not going to join the nursery when I was growing up. Like, this is crazy. A lot of weeding, you know, working every day. This is not a fun thing. However, my dad said, well, Dave, if you join us for a year and you like it, and if I like it, we both agree after 1 year, then you can stay. So the year went past and I liked it. And so I ended up staying. And the reason I ended up staying is because I had a chance, I think, to build something that it's just to try my hand at building something. It wasn't really about the plants, but it was about growing sales, growing a business, growing people, working together. And so that's kind of how I ended up at our company. And so I kind of started out as a salesperson. Well, I started out as general laborer. Then when I came back full time, I started out in sales, and I became sales manager, then general manager. And then my dad was actually the president at the time, and I was pretty aggressive and pushy, and we wanted to get things done. And it worked better when we switched. So then I became president, and then he just became more of an advisor, and that actually worked out really, really well. So that was kind of my transition, and that's over 30 years. But
absolutely. So I definitely want to touch on succession planning, but I'm going to hold that for a little later. So I'm kind of curious, what did you go to university for?
So I started out, I didn't know what to do, so I started out with plant science. Figured out after 1 year that I didn't want to do plant science. So I switched into business administration, which I really enjoyed. Economics and finance, and I really liked all that, going to see different businesses. And then actually at the end, I ended up getting my plant science degree as well. And then because the plant science and business administration are very closely overlapping with agribusiness, so I got a degree in agribusiness also. And for that, it was also kind of interesting because I spent one semester in Chicago working on the Board of Trade and the Stock Exchange and the Mercantile Exchange, and I kind of realized I didn't want to do that. So that was a good internship to realize what I didn't want to do.
So kind of some intuition of your dad there to say, well, he knows what he doesn't want to do. Maybe I'll just shove him somewhere in so he learns what he wants to do.
And I like to move and to convince people, and I'm always trying to persuade and sell. So selling came naturally for me as well. And I really enjoy people, and it worked really, really well. And then I'm involved with the finance side too. So when I was even in high school, I set our company up on spreadsheets for budgets. So that was a good learning education piece too. I know growing up at the supper table, we would talk about business. So I just became kind of interested in business in general. And then when I had an opportunity to join this business, I thought, hey, maybe I'll take a chance and do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of, can you just share a little bit, like some metrics on VanBell, like size and how you fit in the industry?
Sure. I don't think we're the smallest company, and yet we're not the largest either. We're in this spot where we need to grow now. Currently, we have roughly 80 people on staff full time, but in spring, we rise up to about 300, and including in that is about 135 migrant workers. Most of the migrant workers, we have 90% return rate every year, so that's been really, really good. In our spring shipping peak, we're shipping maybe 30 loads a day, 30 semi-trucks out a day, and
That's a lot of plants, and especially if you think about young plants, 30 loads a day, that's a lot of plants.
On the young plant side, we're doing, I'd say, 7 to 8 loads a week, because every truck can hold 40,000 plants, so it just takes a little bit of time to pack up a truck. On the finished plant side, we're doing 29 loads a day. We can do that comfortably. And it's kind of interesting too, because we're at a spot in our company, if we could do an even 20 loads a day or 30 loads a day every day all year, it'd be a piece of cake. But the seasonality of our business is really difficult, and so we're really trying hard to smooth out the seasonality. We typically have done, historically, 80% of our sales came in May. We're down to roughly, I'd say, I might be a little bit off, but maybe half in 1 month. So that spring peak has come down, which is good, but it's still, I think, too much.
So how do you do that? How do you smooth out?
So that's a great question. So what we've really been intentional on is we've had a critical number that we focus on in the finished plants division in particular. Our critical number is non-May sales. So we're all watching every single week, how are we doing on our critical number through the year? We're tracking that to generate sales that are not in May. So does it mean different products? Does it mean different customers, different geographies? How can we keep our forklifts and our trucks running all the time? And I'd say we're moderately successful, and it's getting better. We're getting smarter, and it's still a seasonal business. So we're not there yet, but we're working on it.
So does that just relate to sales, that you sell them not in May, or does that drive right through your...
We want to be shipping plants all year round. So in our young plants business, how that works is we pick up more southern markets. So we start, and you can see it in January, starting in California, and then works up to Oregon, the southeast, like South Carolina, North Carolina. They take plants, Georgia, way sooner than, say, Ontario. And you can see the weather changing. And so we shipped southern states first. So we adapted our product mix, get more southern plants, more intentionality about that type of thing, product development, and also seeking more customers in those areas. So more trade shows, more travel. And so we've been able to ship, I think we ship every week of the year in young plants, we ship something. Now it might not be a truckload, but it's a pallet. And so we've been able to get that smoothed out way more.
So it's not just in sales and shipping, it's even product development. Like you say, we mixed up the product so that we can say, okay, let's find a product for that month.
Yeah, we're trying really hard to just branch out into different products. So, and we're working on that again too. We're with our Bloom and Easy line, we're hoping to release a line of perennials soon too. And so that'll be, perennials are planted in at different times of year than shrubs. So that'll also help smooth out our shipping season. And so more frequent deliveries to the same customers is really, really good. Finding more customers with the same product is really, really good. And so we're just trying to find that right balance.
Absolutely. So that's definitely interesting. So how do you drive that through the company, like that it doesn't start creating a leaky vision, if you will, if you know what I mean by that, saying, okay, so we're in the young plant business. Does that mean any young plant, or does it matter? Is there a certain kind of plant you want to grow, or how do you stay true to your vision but still try to spread it out?
So these are really good questions, and it is a problem because at some points you can get too diluted, right, and less focused. So one thing we have an advantage of, so historically we're doing flowering shrubs. So we really want to make sure we don't drop that ball. That's our bread and butter. And then to buttress that, we have our whole Bloom and Easy line. So we're constantly getting new genetics in, newer and better. And so that's been helpful to keep that fresh. The other fortunate part in our particular company is because we're supplying finished plants, also they require annuals, they require perennials, they require other types of plants from us. And so we have a chance to actually experiment and grow and try different things and see, oh, we actually can grow these. We actually can grow a tissue culture stage 3 plants, bring them in, grow them on, and now sell them to other people. And so, you know, as we grow, we want to see, maybe we can take some of those product lines and sell them to more people still too. For example, perennials.
Do you find you're out there convincing people that possibly this plant is okay in a different month than what they're used to taking?
We're trying to go where the flow is a little bit, go where the water flows easiest. So typically perennials, like we know that because of we're growers too. So the young plants business supplies the finished plants business. So the finished plants business is just like many nurseries in North America. So we know that we plant perennials all times of years. We know that they do too. So we know that if we ship a young plants plant at different times of year, it will work. So that's been not too hard of a stretch to convince people we are already fitting into their pattern. So that's been working pretty well, I'd say.
Absolutely. So kind of sparked another question for me is, do you treat, so you talked about young plant, finished plant, and bloom and easy. Do you treat those as very different? We're kind of sliding into company culture and structure here. Sure. Do you view those as very different departments, or are they quite merged that there's hardly a line between them?
No, that's a great question. They're very different. And it's just an evolution in our company stages. So they used to be just all one company. So to give you a little bit of context, I used to sit at the table with two other people and we'd do production planning. And we would decide how many plants to grow for young plants, and then we'd pot them up into finished plants, and that worked great until it didn't. So then we got to a spot where, you know, it's too complicated. And so we decided, quite a few years ago, 5 or 6 years ago now, we said, let's split them up into separate companies. So they actually have separate income statements, cash flows, and balance sheets. And the reason we did that is to have greater focus per business unit. So that, because part of our philosophy is we want to have the greatest line of sight to the most amount of people, and the people who can make the decisions should be the ones closest to the action. So that way we have twice as many people involved in decision making as before, and they're all motivated to fix their area. And they know what's happening in their area, and so they have the metrics now. And so we've actually intentionally completely separated them. We're very synergistic and we all work together, but we know the results from each business unit.
So do you see like a young plant and a finished plant, are they ever the same plant, or like that, like the industry may see this as a finished plant, but another part of the industry may see that as a young plant. How do you deal with something like that?
So like first, so young plants, you know, like let's say it's a, we have a brand new plant coming out. Well, we have a plant called Wigelia Electric Love. It's a great seller. It's for Bloom and Easy, so we sell that young plant to other growers. They're gonna take, so another grower, including finished plants, will take that young plant and they'll grow it on into a 2 gallon or a 3 gallon, and they'll sell it on to wherever their market is. It could be a box store, or it could be a landscaper. And so to them, that's a finished plant, and to us, a young plant is just it's just the one stage, it's the propagation stage.
And so you grow them separately, you sell them separately, and
separate
facilities, there's a lot of synergies.
Yeah, separate facilities, separate staff, separate farms, completely different. Yeah, separate sales staff, separate facilities, that facility staff that work on that too. And yet we supply each other, young plants, finished plants is a customer for young plants. And so that's one customer among many.
So do you find that focus and that, like you said, that line of sight, that visibility, that what that has created supersedes any overhead and administration fees that breaking it up? Because I'm sure there's higher overheads related to breaking it all up.
At some level there is. That's a great question too. But we feel that the focus is worth any extra cost you might have. And so our company is broken up into young plants, finished plants. We also have an area called shared services. And so each company is not able to support its own accountant and marketing people and computer people and facilities people and HR people. So those are the five areas: HR, IT, marketing, finance, and facilities, right? So shared services supplies services to each business unit. And that way, and if they have a greater need for example, a facilities person that they can sustain their own, then fine, then one person will join just one business unit as a facilities person.
And so the rest still comes from the shared services.
Yeah. So that way we just keep our overhead down, and it's actually more beneficial because they can share. You know, we don't need to have another computer staff lining things up. We can share one, or accounting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or HR. Yeah.
So speaking about kind of that company structure and company culture, tell me a little bit about your company culture.
So I'm super excited about the company culture. That's kind of things I could talk about a long time. So you may have to hold me back a little bit. Growing up, my dad always said, "Dave, you know what? We want to have the best educated, best developed workforce in our industry." And so for 30 years, we've been doing staff lunches, for example. So my mom used to make once a month, you know, for 50, 60, maybe even 100 people, a lunch every month. And then we would go over all the things that were happening in the company for that month. And it wasn't just me talking, it was other people participating. We'd share our sales numbers, we'd share the things that are going on, customer updates, product updates, answer questions, and just have a real good time of togetherness, sharing a meal for an hour, hour and a half, once a month. So company culture has always been really, really important to me. So one other thing that's really important to me also is that it's the idea of continuous learning. So one person asked my dad one time, he goes, "Bill, aren't you worried that you're developing your people and then you're going to spend all this money investing into them and then they're going to take their knowledge and leave?" And he said, "Well, I think that's a greater risk than, that's a lesser risk than having them stay here and be uneducated and not be smart." So we err on the side of trying to develop. That's our whole heart and our spirit. So we've invested, for example, over the years in quite a bit of different cultural things. We started out with lean manufacturing. So back in 2005, let's call it, we shut the whole company down. Everybody stopped work for a whole week, and we went and did, and we brought a lean consultant in, and flowvision.com, they came in and they trained our staff on the concepts and the principles of lean. And it didn't matter if you're me or the secretary, it doesn't matter, we were all in it together. And we use it as a cultural moment also. Every day we'd get together and we'd have food and we'd all learning, and it was just a lot of fun. And then people could go out from there and start learning, how do I apply lean? Next step was we started doing Rockefeller habits, one-page plans and goals and strategies, and how do we line all those things up? Because we had a methodology for improvement. Now, how do we get alignment? So that method, that was really, really a good thing too for us. So we had everybody contributing to what's our mission statement, what's our, you know, our BHAG, what's our annual, our five-year goals, our annual goals and quarterly, and how will we do these things? We didn't do it perfectly, but we got a long ways on it. Next up on culture is the part that I'm really excited about is, I think it was in 2013, I read a book, and it was called The Great Game of Business. And that book was written by Jack Stack, and that book has actually changed a lot of people's lives. So I read this book, and it was the whole story about a group of employees who were facing their factory being closed, and they decided to buy the factory. It was from International Harvester, and the story of how they turned it into a successful company. And they had to run it as an open book management company because they're on the edge the whole time. So they needed everybody's input, everybody's brains to contribute to making the company stay open. So it was such an inspiring story. I went to the conference and I went to a couple workshops. Then I took a bunch of people from our company to the conference and I said, at the end of the conference, can we do this? Will you do this? Because I wanted to have buy-in. So I took myself plus five people and we all said, yep, we're ready to do this. And so now we went on to this whole open book management journey. And we take our cues from a company called SRC, and they're at greatgame.com. That's their website. And it's a whole system that for open book management. And it's not just sharing the finances, it's actually teaching and educating the staff, giving them a voice in how the company's run, and then ultimately giving them a stake in the outcome. So if the company does well, they do well. If it does poorly, you just don't get a profit share. So not just sharing, but actually helping them to influence the direction of the company. And to me, that's a vital distinction, and it's really, really important. And it's been working really, really well. And I'm excited about it. And the philosophy is based on, like with lean or one-page plans, it's all about empowering people. So we want to have people grow and learn, back to my dad's original idea. My parents, both of them actually, they're really strong in education. How do we get everybody in our company to grow and learn and develop professionally and benefit personally.
So that open book management style really fits in with your philosophy of just bring everyone here. It's about educating people, because as you're talking to that, there's a lot of information that you just delivered there. So I want to unpack just a little bit
of that.
Sorry,
I go on.
No apologies needed. I just want to unpack a little bit. So I'm hearing like there's an entire even financial literacy piece to that. So you get someone who's coming on board, you're going to give them a financial statement, an income statement. Where does that start? How do they know that that means something? And you talked about rewards as well. So just maybe unpack that a little bit.
It's a really great observation. It's a huge time commitment to educate people. So I feel like many people who come in the workforce today, they're not educated in business classes. They don't have an idea about income statements or cash flows or balance sheets. And even people coming out of business school, like I have a business administration degree, don't really know as much as we need to. Accountants, they know this mystery language, but they can't explain it many times. So this whole system takes financial statements and makes it accessible to regular people. So that currently, every single week, we have what we call a fiscus huddle. So one of our staff members named our money huddles fiscus, after the Roman god of money, just kind of a humorous thing, and it stuck. And so we meet once a week, and we go through our entire income statement.
And you go line by line?
Line by line, yep. We go, what's our revenue? What's our expenses? What's our overheads? What's our net profit? And then most importantly is, where has everybody this past week forecasted their general ledger line changes so that we know where we're gonna end the year and what changed? And then we just go over the stories. What changed from last week to this week? I got a new customer, our revenue is gonna go up. I paid more for pots, our costs are going up. Shoot, our bottom line went down. And just line by line, every time. And if it's in our situation, if we have a variance that's greater than 5%, we explain it. Otherwise, we just keep on moving. Otherwise, you'd be there forever. It's just a half hour huddle. We go through it. We go through celebrations of other things too. And it's really telling the stories behind the numbers. So when someone joins our company, they have to go through an onboarding process, which we're trying to get much more codified. But one of the things is we explain, why are we playing the great game of business? And at the end of the day, it's so that people can have a voice in the company, get educated on it, and have a stake in the outcome, because we want them to do well personally, financially, and develop professionally, back to our original vision for how do we develop staff. So if we can do those things, people find it magical. And the beautiful thing is, so we even teach it for our foreign seasonal workers too, our Mexican guys. Some of them, they're benefiting, like it's pretty interesting because now they understand income statements and cash flow and balance sheet. It's harder, we have to work on that, but they're going back to Mexico and they're buying farms. They're buying, one guy bought a taxi service and he bought a computer internet cafe, and other people are putting floors in their homes or indoor plumbing.
So you're not just having foreign workers coming here, you're creating a whole generation of entrepreneurs.
We're trying to create it. One of our mottos is everyone an entrepreneur. We have that painted in about a 15-foot wide banner on our walls. Everyone an entrepreneur, because we wanted people to think and act and feel like owners, including our seasonal workers. So it's truly dramatically, I would say, life impacting for many people, because now they're understanding, wait a minute, if I spend this, this is what'll happen. And really, we all have income statements, cash flows, and balance sheets in our personal life, right? Our income state, you know, our cash flow, are we getting paid every 2 weeks? Our income statement, how much are we keeping? Our balance sheet, what are we investing in? Did I buy a car or a house?
So when we're talking about the foreign worker who's coming in, are they in your fiscus huddle as well?
Yes.
So like the entire company is there?
So we've changed, so it used to be historically, the entire company would come. And now, because we're up, you know, 300 people, it's getting a bit much. So, and then we also found that we would do English, Spanish translations all the time. It just took twice as much time. So half the time, the English people can't understand the Spanish translation and we're waiting. So now we actually do English only and separate Spanish huddles. And we do that currently. And another benefit we found to that too, the cultural piece I was fearful of is that we were not gonna be together as much. I'm not gonna see Jose or Pablo or Juan as much. However, the questions that the Mexican guys ask are different than the questions that the English people.
Cultural translation.
Yeah, and they actually feel much more comfortable asking questions in a smaller group in their own language, and we tailor it for them. Because these guys have a lot to offer. sometimes I think in our industry, people say, well, foreign workers are coming up, they're not that smart, whatever, they just work here and they don't really care. But you know what? Actually, they do care. And they take pride in the place that they work at. So, and I take pride in those guys too. I really have a genuine bond with a lot of them. And I really feel like, you know, they're up here in Canada trying to make a difference. Let's help them. So if we can help them learn, help them grow, they're going to benefit. They're not here to become citizens. They're here to make money and to support their families and to send their girls to school because the public schools are terrible there and make a better life for themselves. And so this is kind of a way for us to actually help a third world country develop. So our huddles are in Spanish and we gear it to their.
So you obviously do that there, but you're also doing that for your 80 full-time local employees as well,
yep.
Above and beyond that.
Yep.
So just another question. So what do you do with the employee that goes home and says, I know how much Dave makes?
So the only thing we don't share is salaries.
Okay.
So we don't share individual salaries with anybody, but they absolutely know how much Van Bell Nursery is making and how much we're projected to make.
Yep. And
the percent, the dollars, everything.
So if they, like you said, it's still a lesser risk if they know that than if they're uneducated working for me.
Yeah.
That's something, did that take some getting used to, or is it because you grew up in that was just?
So that's a great question too. So I'm naturally a trusting person. So I extend trust until someone breaks it. If they break it, then it's over. But I extend trust that way. So what we do is we expect that people will honor what they learned and not share it. And we also expect that, see, the reason why it's also easier to do is because if you're a typical business owner, this has been borne out by survey after survey after survey, and it was true at our place too. The average person working in a company thinks that the owner backs up the truck on Friday afternoons and loads up the money and drives to the bank. And they think, and then here's the shocking stat. So the average person just working in any business, this is true across America or any business, the average person who does not have access to the financials of that company thinks that the owner is making a 50% profit, 50. So, hey, they might share revenue. Well, guess what? We sold, you know, $1 million this year. Well, that employee is thinking that owner took home $500,000 in their back pocket. And that is terrible because that's, I don't know anybody who can do that. And so what ends up happening is the employee thinks, you know what? If I just slack off here, that's fine. If I just don't do that, that's okay. They won't miss it if I just do whatever. And it gives an excuse for all kinds of, I think, poor behavior. When they know the truth, the average company in North America, if they can make 5% net income per year, that's about average. That's pretty good. If you're in the grocery business, if you can make 1.5%, that's amazing.
So the philosophy is that if they can see that the thing they did actually took a percentage point off is much better learning opportunity than if they see that you're making 6 points.
Yep. Yep. So we say, and then we also teach too, a business has to make a profit. If a business cannot make a profit, there's no jobs. So it's job security, and it's a chance that when you're out there in the nursery at our place, for example, and you're working away and you realize, hey, I can save our company money by doing this. And if I do that and they're going to accept my suggestion and we save this money, then we're going to have a higher profit share and I'm going to benefit personally. Awesome. So one of my favorite stories is, so when we pay our profit share out quarterly, and a lot of the Mexican guys are gone home by November, they come back in January, and the first thing we do is give them, if we have a profit share, which doesn't happen every year, if we have one, the day they get back, we give them their fourth quarter profit share check. And when they come off the bus, and they step into our parking lot, and we start welcoming them out, we start passing out profit share checks right then, yeah, their eyes light up, and it's great because they are going to start wiring that money home immediately, and they're going to right away, they're in a great spot, and they are more dedicated than ever. So we're buying a lot of loyalty. And here's another thing, I guess. So we used to, you know, in the Industrial Revolution, people had to work hard. You want to work with your hands? Work fast. Then came the Information Revolution, right? Now you got to work smart with your head. Well, at Van Bell, I'm trying to go to the next step. We want your hands. We want you to work hard. We want your heart. We want your head to work smart. And we also want your loyalty. We want your heart. When I give a guy a check after he steps off the bus, after his long flight from Mexico, and he comes and he's ready to go to his room and he's back again for the 14th year and he gets a check, you know what? We've got his loyalty. And he's going to do his best to make sure our company is successful. So if our company can be successful, I'm successful. And if I'm successful, they're successful. We're all aligned the same way. So it's a beautiful system, but you have to get over the idea that it costs a lot of money and you have to be willing to trust.
Yeah, absolutely. And just even that whole concept of, sure, you're giving them a check, but there's probably a lot of psychological elements in that check that it's telling that we care about you. We didn't have to give this to you. You haven't even started working yet.
Yep.
And that's where that trust element. So it's not just about buying their trust. It's actually it's actually a token, an indication that you're willing to step up when you said you would.
That's very well said. That's very well said. You should come work for Van Bell this year. Amen. Yes. You're right. We're not buying their trust. We're earning their trust. And you know what? I have high loyalty to those guys and to our staff in general. And I would hope that we could get that same back.
So when you were talking there too about that a business has to make profit, a little thought came to my mind. Something that Simon Sinek likes to say as well is he says that, you know, you need fuel to keep the car going, right? Yeah. So we're driving the car. The fuel is the profit that we're making.
Yeah.
And I need the fuel to keep the car going down the road. Yeah. If we run out of fuel, we run out of company.
Totally agree. So it's one of the things that we teach is that can you be profitable and go broke? And most people say, no. Well, it's actually true. You can be profitable and go broke if you run out of cash. So we're putting a heavier emphasis on cash flow in 2023. How do we teach cash flow to people? Because are we getting terms? Are we paying too quick? Are we getting discounts? Are we spending money correctly? Are we investing in too much inventory? That's a big one in this industry. Your inventory is out of whack. That's just so much money. It just sucks the cash or the lifeblood out of a business. So we got caught in 2021 and 2022 with these market changes a little bit too. Our inventory was out of whack. And so we're putting a greater emphasis on it. And the reason is for cash flow. So if we can get our cash flow turning better, we'll make more profit and people will be happier. And job security and, you know, move up the Maslow's
hierarchy of needs.
Yeah, absolutely, just love it. I, you know, as with my psychology background, I worked in the mental health field for a little while too. And I know one of the key indicators that they talk about in mental health and success and Maslow's hierarchy of needs, all that is financial literacy. So there's a lot of grassroots nonprofit organizations that focus on putting out financial literacy. Yeah, so just love to see how you're taking that to the next level and saying, we're embedding that into your employment structure.
Yeah, we're really trying to do that well. And if anybody's interested, they can go to greatgame.com and there's all kinds of material there. It's not inexpensive. It's expensive in terms of learning, the learning curve, the time invested in daily huddles, weekly FISCUS huddles. We do high involvement planning all September, October, November, December. And then we're going to be probably moving to perpetual planning. So we have rolling forecasts. So we have everybody in the company doing these things. And so most people in our company have a general ledger line that they're responsible to forecast and to manage. So if we're buying gloves or pots or fertilizer or soil or whatever it is, pens, paper in the office.
Absolutely. So we focus a lot on that financial piece. So let's just swing over to another couple of things. And these are just a few tidbits that you threw out. So I just want to pick up on those is you really talked about helping people grow and don't take credit for things that like just expand on. I think you might have mentioned that in our call earlier. You said help people grow. Don't always take credit for the wins. Like, explain that concept.
Yeah, we want to have people. We want to develop people so that they can make good decisions on their own. It's not about ego, it's not about title, and it's not about positional authority. We want to lead with earned authority. So with our management team, how do we get people to lead? No one's going to follow you if you turn by, I don't believe in today's day and age, in today's job market, there's too many options. If you want to have, the only way it works is in the military. We want to have people lead, grow by example. So really we want to have the ideas come from everybody. And sometimes the people who are closest to the action have the best ideas. We had a fellow here, a fellow from Mexico. He suggested to us that we change one of our shipping processes to include a double wide unloading dock. And without explaining it all, it was a brilliant idea. It was low cost and it doubled our efficiency just from his idea. It was beautiful. We recognized him. We clapped for them and we all got an increased profit share because of that person's idea. So we don't want to come in with the idea that I know all the answers. And I'm not sure if it's like you, but as I get older, I realize I know less actually. And it's just about more people and the wisdom of the crowd, people who are self-motivated. So we want to celebrate everybody.
Absolutely. So I want to, yeah, absolutely. So it's just about celebrating everybody and bringing that in. So I want to bring into that wisdom of the crowd. But before I go there, I think it might actually be IBM. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that whole concept of, I think they were going to lose a lot of money on something, and the CEO decided to say, well, the person closest to the problem probably has the solution. And so he walked out to the floor, started talking to that engineer, and came out with like a multi-million dollar savings because of the solution that that person came up with. So how do you implement that in a larger company? Do you have like 55 ideas an hour coming at you, and how do you weed through that? Just maybe.
That's a really good question too. So one mechanism we have for that. Well, first off, on the company culture side, we celebrate, one of our core values is find a better way. So when people find a better way to do something, we call that out every week, and we celebrate it, and we clap, and we acknowledge and recognize those people. We also have there's other mechanisms that we can use, such as mini games is what we call it. Mini games are an opportunity to take advantage of an opportunity or to solve a problem. It's typically a short 90-day sprint, and we put it up on the wall. And what we do is we get together a group of people and we say, what is the greatest problem that we're facing right now? And we all vote on the greatest problem. Because yes, if you have 55 ideas a day, of which usually I have 55 ideas a day myself, and I, you know, most of them we can't do. So with the group, we can kind of weed through those things, find out, you know what, this is actually the greatest area of focus that we have to have. Let's put a mini game on it. It also works in our high involvement planning process for budgeting for the next year. We review the current year and we say, here's our top five goals. What are the goals trying to solve? What are we trying to do back to our mission? What are we trying to do to achieve our mission and our vision, our goals? And with our goals, we try to solve our top problems. And then so we're always every week measuring, are we hitting our goals? And it's pretty interesting because this year in our finished plans division, we just had a review and three of our five goals we didn't hit. So three X's and two green check marks. So people are a little bit disappointed about that. And it's not surprised because we've been tracking it all year. So now we have to adjust our goals for the coming year. And what are we going to do to make sure that we hit it? And so it's really a group effort. So everybody in our company is involved in these meetings and decisions. And we just kind of have it structured so that different people take on different areas. And then we come together and we vote on it and this sort of thing.
So is that that mini game thing, is that a part of the Great Game theory?
It's all part of the Great Game.
Because it reminds me a lot of Patrick Lencioni's work, which is all about what's most important right now. Yep. Spend 3 to 4 months working on that issue, move on to the next one. Yep. And same thing with the red, green lights is the way his model works. So it's very similar to that.
Very similar.
So how do you rally people around that? Do you still have other ideas flowing at the same time, or do you really focus on that one? Because I find I do a bit of business coaching as well, and I find that's a really big struggle for a business owner or a president to say, we're focusing on this one issue, what happens to the other 99 important ones?
Yep. So that's another great question, and I also struggle with that because there's too many things to do at once, and they're all great. So we do try to limit it a little bit, but we can have multiple mini games running at once. And on our weekly Fiscus huddles, we limit it to about five key performance indicators that we track every week. And then that's about all we can handle.
Five KPIs or key performance indicators per mini game or total?
A total at any one moment. Yeah, we have five KPIs for the year, and then mini games run separately.
Okay, so the KPIs are more just indicators of the business. They're not necessarily, because, and again, just pardon me if I get this wrong, but the Lencioni model kind of has KPIs built into each mini game. So, you said, we hit five, but three of them weren't hitting them.
Yeah. So for a mini game, that's a little bit different. That's a great clarifying question. So a mini game is designed to solve a specific problem or take advantage of a specific opportunity. And we just it's only the one thing. When I talk about our KPIs, I'm talking about each business unit has our five KPIs per year based on our goals. And the KPIs are all activity-based things. They're not results-based things. They're like, so for example, if we want to increase our sales, one KPI could be how many presentations are we making to new prospects? We have a goal around that this year. Oh, we're aiming for, like, for this year, we had a scoreboard and everything. So it was like a, you know, football scoreboard. And guess what? And every week, did we increase our goal? Oh, right. People have to pay attention to that. We want to get in front of customers. So Yeah, a little bit different, and yet it's...
Well, they can work together is what I'm hearing as well, is because you could be looking at this KPIs over a year or every month or every week, and if one keeps consistently staying red or what X or whatever, that could be an indication that you need to vote that up into a mini game or that it needs to become a mini, because it's like, so how do we get more presentations could be your mini game kind of idea.
That's an excellent way to put it.
That's interesting. So now, who keeps this all up? Like, you got these mini games going, you got celebrations going, so is there someone in charge of all of that?
Yes and no. So for our Fiscus huddles, there's a couple of the team leads are in charge of it, and then everybody participates. So at the huddle, there's about seven people responsible for updating information on the slides. Everybody's responsible for asking questions. Everybody's responsible for sharing core values and celebrating people that they've remembered through the week. And so we just kind of follow the same format each time, and we try to tweak it a little bit to improve it. And it seems to work pretty good. But the person in charge of the business unit of each one is ultimately responsible to make sure that that happens. But they just delegate out and people rise up, and it's kind of fun, right? It's also a bit of lots of laughing. You want to be there. Sometimes we have treats. We always end on a cheer. And it's the sillier, the better, because we just really want to have people, you want to feel almost like a little bit of a pep rally. And so it's kind of a fun thing to go to. And so people go and they volunteer. And you know what? We try to celebrate the positive things. We don't sugarcoat things either. When things go poorly, we let people know. Because again, we don't want to have surprises. We want to know where the numbers are going to be at for the end of the year all the time. So there should be no surprises in our company.
No sacred cows.
No sacred cows.
It reminds me of a talk I listened to from Alan Mulally, CEO of Ford.
Right.
And I remember when he took over Ford, he was talking about this. He said he took over in his first meeting, they had all green lights, and yet they were on track to lose $17 billion that year. And he's like, clearly we must have some sacred cows in the room. It's a fascinating story. So you don't really have a person that says, oh, it's time for this lunch or it's time for a cheer. It's just you've got it so ingrained in your culture. It's kind of like showing up for a baseball game. People just know they got to cheer when there's a home run.
That's right.
It's just embedded in it.
Then we try to calendar it out too. So 2023, pretty soon here, I'll be putting all the next year's meetings in, and pretty soon it won't be me anymore doing it. But we'll schedule all the times for the calendar in the coming year. And everybody's invited to those different meetings. And so they just know it's there. Our daily huddle rhythms just continue on. Our weekly huddle rhythms just continue on too. We have a mid-year review. We have in September, October, November, December. We have all those meetings all scheduled out too. And we keep track of it every year, also by year and by month, so we can always refer back to the prior year. How do we do? And what can we do better? We do postmortems also to try to improve it.
So this might be a little bit of a deeper question is. I'm always fascinated by the psychology of praise and reward and punishment and all that stuff. How does that play into a culture where everything is always being cheered on and someone's doing a really good job, but they're never hitting the cheers? Like they're never just at that point. What does that do to those people's motivation and stuff? Is it something you've thought about?
This is something that sometimes we struggle with a little bit too, because what if someone doesn't consistently hit their targets? What do you do? Well, I would like to think that we don't want to let the rest of the team down. And so we will make our targets. Now, sometimes things do happen that you cannot make it. But then we all have to come together and say, hey, how are we going to help solve this? If people consistently let their team members down, it's a bit of a self-selection thing too. People self-select out of that because you can't hide. Your numbers are on the screen every week. So if you're consistently over budget or over budget, or if every week you say, yeah, I got to check into that, you know what? People start noticing and your social capital goes down. So and even for me, I don't want to let the team down myself. So I have to be on my game. And is it perfect? No. And can we improve it? Yes.
So how do you differentiate between those who are unable to ask for help and those who are just not doing it because they aren't really putting in the effort?
How do we differentiate between that?
Because like you say, if somebody's they're just not hitting it every week, is there a time and a place for the person who's like, well, because I imagine that you're okay. I would imagine in the culture that you're explaining to me, you're okay with that person saying, hey, I just need help with this. I know I'm not hitting my numbers. But what if that person isn't able to get there? How does that work out?
We always encourage people to ask for help. Don't spin your wheels. Just ask for help now. I ask for help all the time. And we also tell people it's okay to make mistakes, because guess what? I make a mistake every single day too, lots of them. So it's far worse to not try. That we can't abide. So if people are not putting in effort, they get called out, and they cannot, one of our core values is best effort. If they're gonna just kind of mail it in, they can't last at our company a long time. It just won't happen. We're all gonna see it, and they need to move on. It's just as simple as that. People don't have all the answers, but if people are willing to try, for me, I would hope that our culture is lots of patience for that.
So how do you, you talked about, you've mentioned two of your core values. It sounds like in the meetings, you're actually calling out those core values. Yep. Is that the way you're embedding, or how do you embed core values?
So we call it values in action. So we have five core values at our company. Best effort, always positive, respect people, find a better way, and do it now. Those are the five. And we call them out every single week in a little section of our huddle called values in action. So, hey, it's time for values in action. We have on the screen all of our core values, and we just ask for people from the crowd, and it's not forced, and if there is none, there is none, but usually there is. Hey, I want to recognize this person because of the extraordinary effort they put into this past week. This was a situation. They went above and beyond, and so you know what? We want to recognize that person for best effort. Way to go. And we all clap, right? And usually there's probably five or six every week.
Yeah. Yeah. So yes, you're making a time to do that, but at the same time, you're actually intrinsically embedding those values, because everyone's hearing them every time, and they're seeing what does that look like in action and things like that.
And then I don't even lead that, but once in a while I speak into it too, and we just reinforce those values. Best effort, do it now, don't wait. Find a better way. You found something better, respect people. Hey, there's lots of those. Always positive, because we have problems all the time too. And so how do we deal with our problems? It's not about, hey, putting on a happy face and being fake. It's about how do we approach that problem in a positive manner to make it work, because the problems will always be with us. So yeah, we're just constantly preaching on it.
So you're doing that on a day-to-day business day-to-day in your business.
Yep.
How does that translate up into driving that down into the company? And what I mean by is, so you have a vision for the company. How are you taking that, making that, and then holding to that?
Yeah, so that's a great question too. So I'm not perfect at it, and I've got a business coach to help me so that I can learn as well, because I'm making this up as I go too, just like everybody else in life. We're all kind of feeling our way through. But what I did, in our September kickoff for our budget, I review, why are we here? What's our mission? What's our vision? And then I went through our organization chart changes and our organization changes, so the whole company could hear it. Down to the level of, in this particular case, here's some reporting changes, and here's why, and here's some role title changes, and here's why. And if you have any questions, please see me afterward, no problem. You can ask them now, or afterward if you're not comfortable, ask them now. We put our org charts up on the wall, and we put stuff up on walls so that people can read it. And in the lunchroom, it says everyone entrepreneur. It says what that all means. Our core values are up there too. They're on our wall. You can see them every day. They're in our orientation. When people join our company, it's on our website. Anybody can just listen, just go to our website and you can see me talking about it.
So you said you do this in which meeting, the budget meeting you said, or in the...
Yeah, so that was at our all company kickoff. Basically, every time I have a chance to talk to people,
you do.
I talk about it.
So you have this meeting and the whole company shows up again.
Yeah, the whole company team.
So that's how you're driving the message. It's not, you're sending not sending out a WhatsApp message or a text message.
No.
It's
in person every week on our fiscus huddles and in our budget meetings. The whole company came, for example, last week, Friday. So I led off the first hour with a bunch of different topics I wanted to cover off with everybody. And then we had our engagement surveys. We shared with everybody too. How are we doing as a company? Here you all filled in the engagement surveys. It's all anonymous. We have no idea what people said, but we shared the results. We want to be transparent. We want to give people the good, the bad, the truth. And then after that, it was a couple, each business unit presented on where their initial plans for the next year are. And then we had a big cake afterward too, because Bloom and Easy turned 10. So we had cupcakes and smiles and cheerful, we had music playing, and then we all had a big lunch together too, and people can come and go and stay as long as they want and go back to work when they're ready. There's no strict time limit on it because we want to build culture.
So let's just go a little higher level. You're the president.
Yeah.
Do you have a team that you surround yourself with that helps you craft that vision? Like you already talked about having a coach, you have a board. Like, how does that fit together?
Yes. So I'm learning on this whole thing too. So I've always had business coaches my entire career, and so far I've been very thankful because it's really been very helpful for me. So my current business coach, I think, I don't know for certain, it's predictablesuccess.com. I read this fellow's name, his book from Les McEwen. So I actually coached directly with him. So he's been around the corner. So we believe in 20 up, 20 down, a mentor of 20 years older, and we mentor people 20 years below. So he's seen around more corners. And so even today I had my coaching call with Les, and he gave me some advice. He says, Dave, I've seen these sort of things happen before. Here's what I recommend that you do. And so that's been really helpful. And so Les has helped me structure my company so that now I have just as of last month, only 5 direct reports. And each one of them is, we changed our titles to call them all vice presidents. And it's just for clarity for internal and external people. It's not about ego or, you know, look at me, I'm a vice president or whatever. Because for the longest time, William, I didn't even want the word president on my business card because I don't really, but people say, well, yeah, sure. Yeah, you get the last name, so it doesn't matter. Well, okay. So for clarity, we changed that all. So now I only have 5 people reporting to me. They're all vice presidents and they're all responsible for specific areas. So I have to change how I manage too, because I like just to go and talk with the people. I like to go right to the source too. But as we grow, we have to change. I have to change. So it's been a bit of a learning curve for me, and it's been good actually. I've been really enjoying it. And so I have the 5, so it's me plus 5, myself plus 5 people, and we're the leadership group. And so any big policy decisions, I don't make them. We decide them together. And then we also float them out to people too and make sure it all works for our culture. And that's how we've been starting to operate now too. That's even since this summer.
Yeah. And that really, so your channel, and that's just to grow the company, but those people are obviously heavily invested in the same model and they're flowing that communication through the same way.
They have to be bought into all the philosophies that I'm in.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's just not going to work.
So it's team first, it's that first, and then everything else second.
Team first. And it's interesting because we've got a lot of talented people. And some have left, some have come back. The ones that come back have been really, I'd say, we're actually grateful to have them back when they come back with the attitude of, you know what, I was over there, it didn't really work, now I'm here and I realize, wow, what I had, and I'm super committed, because they actually tell everybody else. And so that's awesome. And so the culture is really the number one thing. And we've actually also not hired people on account of culture. And we've definitely let people go on account of culture.
So kind of that whole theory again of values, you're hiring and firing on those values and on your culture and stuff like that.
And if we let someone go on our values, it's probably because we had a mishire at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So the old adage, if something's not working, you're either training wrong or hired wrong. It's pretty much the only two things that...
I know. So I have to take responsibility at the end of the day that maybe we hired wrong. Well, how come we were hiring wrong? I used to do the hiring myself. So how do I actually transmit what I'd like to see hired into other people so that they can also have that? And by the way, Les told me oftentimes the entrepreneur is the worst person to do the hiring. So as we go, it's kind of exciting. I'm continually reminded about how much talent other people have and that I don't actually need to solve that problem. They'll actually be able to do a much better job. I mean, I've always kind of known that, but it's just clear to me.
Well, that's a perfect segue into the question is how do you attract talent?
How to attract talent? That's a really good question.
Like the talent you're looking for. Yeah. Like you said, we make mistakes, but how do you attract that talent that fits the culture? Like just maybe.
Yep. We're trying to be super intentional about it now. So one of our primary sources of talent attraction is referrals. So for one thing, we ask internal staff, hey, do you know somebody? If they can bring someone on and they stay 6 months, there's a monetary reward for that person
referral, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. And then we also interview heavily on, we base it on culture. So we try to do a really good job of selling ourselves to people who want to work at our company too. So that they're excited, because we want to have people excited to come to work for us, because then we have more people coming and then we can kind of pick and choose a bit more.
How do you sell yourself?
So we set up social media accounts. We do, the way we advertise, our website's a big driver of it too. Some of our staff, they post on their own personal social media too.
Okay, so you're not only selling yourself to your customers, you're actually selling Van Bell to your employees?
That's a terrific point. And that really was brought home to me at this past Great Game of Business conference. It's really, again, all about the people. So if we can sell our staff as we're the best place to work, they're going to go home to their families. We want to get their families involved. We want to get the spouses of people who work at our company to say, you'd be crazy to leave that job. We love it that you work there. We're invested in it too. So we want to sell ourselves to our staff too. So in October, we're doing a first time, well, we've done versions of this before, but we're going to be much more intentional about this coming October. We're going to do an event for all our staff and make sure as many families can come as possible. And we're going to have a whole bunch of things for kids and bouncy castles and all that sort of stuff, and tug of war and games and food and all, and tours. So anybody can come, they can bring their family along, they can bring their friends along. We don't really care who they bring along, just RSVP, come along. And because we know that if their staff are proud to show their family where they're working and what they're doing, it just keeps on spreading more word of mouth. So we do things like that that just help us retain and attract more talent. And so we're not perfect, but we've been able to, I think, build a great group of people. And the leadership is also critical. If we get the right leaders, it just keeps going. And so one focus we've had this year, one of our leaders, one of our new guys this year said, Dave, you know what we want to do is one of our goals is to have at least 6 out of 10 hires and promotions in our company come from internal people. So we're putting on right now a leadership development, a whole series of classes on leadership development. It's going to be every other week for a couple hours. There's homework in between. The people get together. There's a whole presentation and videos and everything else to watch and to do and to interact with. And people are asking for that. So we're meeting our staff where they want to be helped. And I think that buys a lot of loyalty too, and earns a lot of loyalty. And if they stay more educated, it's even better because they'll be motivated to make our company better.
So when you look at that, because what I'm kind of thinking, I know you mentioned the Industrial Revolution before too, that was really, you pick up your lunch pail, you go work for your 8 hours, right. The company will take care of you when you retire. You come home with your lunch pail, you're done the day, you do the rest of your, then we kind of shifted to, let's bring, all the animals, let's bring all the slides and the fun stuff to work so you can have gyms at work and all that stuff. That didn't really work as well either. Is that just an evolving thing as generations go on, or are we still just trying to find our way? Like, how do we make work part of the family and the family part of the work? And
finding that balance is really difficult. So what we're trying to do intentionally, sometimes you can have a bit of a murder syndrome, right? People who work long hours, who don't take vacations, and look at me and I'm really contributing. Well, we're actually trying to flip that a little bit and say, look, take your vacations. Do not call in. Please leave your work phone at home. We celebrate you when you leave. And I have to model that by example too, which I've not always been good at. So trying to find that right mix in our culture of how do we do work well is not easy. But it's incumbent upon businesses to figure this out because there's not enough people. I think I read a statistic the other day, by 2030, there's going to be 85 million open jobs in the United States. It sounds eye-poppingly crazy, and maybe it is, but the fact is there's still not enough people. So somehow or other, how do we get the people that we need and beat the next guy?
Which is going to bring you right back to your original training with Lean. Do more with less?
Right? Yeah, that's right. So we have people. So I'm pretty proud. We just installed these sticking robots. We're actually doing it right now. And the people who are leading the development of the installation are all young female minorities, English, second language people who are very bright and very capable and need a chance. And I'm so proud of them, and they're doing great. And other people might in their home countries overlook them, but here they have a chance to really grow and thrive. And so one of them actually just went to a conference in Denver. I just saw it the other day too. Perfect. So grow, develop people. Will have much greater loyalty, and if they can be successful, we can be successful, and if we're successful, we want to make them successful. So it's a nice symbiosis.
Which is interesting because you talked about Lean earlier, and I just finished having a podcast episode with Hank Rosendahl from Qualitree,
right.
Who also just ordered their first ISO robot. And we talked, at length for an hour and a bit about continuous improvement and automation and stuff. So definitely very interesting to see that you're innovating on that side too, which brings me to a question about innovation. You brought Bloomin' Easy 10 years ago, you said?
We started it 10 years ago.
So that's a huge piece of innovation. Just talk to me a little bit. You already talked about the automation very, very briefly, but innovation, how is that playing a role?
So on the Bloom and Easy side, we're very excited about it because it's a brand for young homeowners. It's very clear. It's young homeowners.
You're wearing the shirt.
Wearing the shirt. Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. So we're very targeted in our marketing, in our social media. We do for innovation. So when a young homeowner, the number one problem that plant buyers have when they walk into a store, A, they don't know what they want to buy. So that's problem number one. They have no idea. And two, they're worried if they buy something, they're going to kill it. So how we address that, our plant package we think is the best in the industry. It says Bloomin' Easy. So Blooms Easy, those are nice, good words. It's a nice blue pot. It's a catchy pot. And it says Plant, Water, Relax on the pot. The tag is relating to people. We have people on all of our tags. Nobody else does this yet. Probably it'll change. We have after purchase support. So if someone wants to scan the QR code, they're going to get an email in spring. Hey, it's time to prune your hydrangea, or it's time to mulch in the fall, or whatever it is we have based on your zip code. So that's been an innovation. And I'm really proud to say that other things we've done innovations on too in our company have been staff driven, but we ship potless. So all of our young plants go to our customers across North America with no pots. And they think, how is that possible? No pots. Well, we make sure that the little young plant is rooted so well that when we pull it out of our tray, we designed a tray that we've got patented and trademarked. The tray stays at the nursery. The plant goes in the box. The box goes to the customer. It cubes out terrifically. So we have lower percentage freight rates from the West Coast, even than from people in the Midwest to the East Coast. And they have no garbage. When a customer gets our plants with no pots, there's no garbage to clean up. There's less labor. And then the other secret we found out is we found a new way to put plants in cardboard boxes that can hold water and don't break. Because we used to ship everything in waxed boxes. So most of our industry ships on racks, you gotta get them back. Wood racks, very expensive, and you gotta put them away. Waxed boxes, they're terrible for the environment. Our boxes are recyclable and they hold water, and I can't tell you the secret. Also, partially because I can't pronounce the scientific name of what the polymers are on the box, but it's just an innovation that we feel is good for the environment, it's good for economy, it's good for our country, it's good for our customers, it's a win-win all the way through.
Yeah, so and that's kind of exactly what I was gonna comment on, is you're innovating right from the bottom up. It's the automation piece, but also the product that's getting shipped to the sales piece to how can we cater best to that, you know, that whole Bloomin' Easy concept. Because like you said, yes, that's the first thing I always worry about. Can I keep this alive? Which, like you said, we have pictures of people. I've always been curious about that. Why is there a picture of the flower on the tag? Isn't the flower that I'm already buying
on the
in
plant.
Front of me?
Yes,
so that's right. It's just increasing my level of anxiety because I'm like, oh, it's supposed to look like that?
Right. And then, good point. Yeah. Good point. Yeah, so on our tags, we typically have people with phones and a landscape shot perhaps. But yeah, you can see the plant right in front of you.
So you're not selling plants, you're selling better lives.
We're selling better lives. We're selling a sense of, okay, this is gonna work for me. I can be successful here. You're selling beauty, right? You're selling a bit of happiness. If you buy a bouquet of roses, it's, you know, and we're also trying to work our plants lower on the commitment scale. So if you buy a tree, it's the ultimate commitment. People take forever to buy a tree because they know it's gonna last a long time. But if you buy a bouquet of roses, that's the lowest on the commitment scale. So they know that it's going to, or a poinsettia. They know it's
other than the commitment you might be trying to get
that's
with
right.
the roses.
But. Yeah, maybe you're going to get something different. But you know the poinsettia is not going to last more than 2 weeks, so it's gone, right? So how do we get our plants, shrubs, lower on the commitment scale? So people say, you know what? I'll buy a shrub. I'll take a chance. I'll plant it, and it's going to be fine. Plant, water, relax. And if I don't like it in the future, I'll do another one.
So even on your sales philosophy, you're not just selling widgets or this. You're just like, you don't just grow plants. You are here to educate people and sell the company to people. You're doing the same thing on the sales. So that philosophy is end to end.
End to end, yep.
Through the organization.
So we're trying to sell with Bloomin' Easy right to the end consumer, to our grower partners, a better young plant. And in our young plants, we're trying to do lean. And it all flows together to help the whole process become smoother and just remove transactional friction anywhere. Or emotional friction, right? Maybe people are hesitant to buy. So how do we do that? And that's, we're always trying to figure this stuff out. So I'm always looking at other nurseries as well, because there are so many smart people in this industry and other industries that have other things figured out so well that we can learn. We do not have a monopoly on we're shameless copiers of other people's ideas.
I guess that's the old adage with any new innovation. Usually it's the person who comes in second that improves it and then does really, really well, right? Yeah. We just have to look at cell phone market, any of those. They're not the person who came up with the idea. They're the ones who improved on it.
Yeah.
So tell me just a little bit as we wrap up here in terms of what's next for Van Bell?
Well, for me personally, I'm really trying to figure out the next 3 to 5 years. What is our company going to look like? What am I going to be doing? How do we transition this company? What does our succession plans look like? I was actually speaking to the author of this book one time. He said, Dave, every business owner exits either one of two ways, happy or not happy. How do we exit happy, right? There's different options for that. So I'm trying to do a lot more exploration of how do we do that? I've got lots of time, but the thing is you need to start early. So how do we do these things and do them well, honoring the staff that we have, honoring our customers and our clients, our vendors too. In difficult times, our vendors stuck with us, like during COVID, for example. So we have a high degree of loyalty to them as well. How do we do all these things in a way that's God-honoring and serves other people well too? At the end of the day, I'm going to be in the grave. We're all going to be in the grave. Sounds kind of morbid. And yet, really, life is not about... It's like life is about being, faithful, not successful. How do we be faithful to all the people who we're interacting with and live life in a way that's honoring to them too?
Absolutely wise words. Is there a third generation?
So I've got 5 kids. Okay. So my oldest is 21 and my second one is 19. They're both in university. I'm really proud of them. My daughter's in her last year of high school and I've got 2 younger sons. My youngest son is 10. So I've got, I'm not encouraging my kids to come into our company. If they do, we'll see what happens. My dad always said, Dave, you need to leave our company. You need to go work other places. After high school, I didn't work at our company anymore. And even when I was 16, my dad said, go work someplace else. So I really was gone a long time at our company. I got other experiences, worked at a bank, and did internships. So for my own kids too, they need to find their own path. And will it lead back to our company? It's too soon to say, but I'm not banking on it. I'm planning on having a different transition of some sort, which I'm not totally sure about which that is, and that's why I need to go away and think about these things more too. And really my dream for my kids personally is that can they be happy doing something that, can they be successful and be happy at the same time doing something that they love? That's perfect.
So you'd rather be part of their happy success rather than saying you need to come and work for me?
Yeah, I'm definitely not going to.
With me.
Yeah, this is a tough business. Anybody who's listening to this podcast who has a nursery business realizes this is a difficult business and there's got to be better ways to make money. And yet there's lots of joy too. So that's not to dismiss or diminish that aspect, but it's not easy. And so you really got to be committed. And if you're going to come here against your will, as one of my kids, let's say, it's not going to work. So, and also if they don't come, it's a lot easier for me too, from a keeping the family peace point of view, maybe.
Yeah, we'll see. Which, because you know Gerard Schuner.
Yeah.
I interviewed him as a podcast as well. So there are, he's third generation coming on board and there's even a fourth generation already there. And we talked a little bit about the dynamics of family and how do you talk about it at the supper table.
It's difficult.
And you know that with your dad as well. So absolutely. So that's definitely interesting. So that's a journey that you're kind of exploring right now.
And my sister used to work for us full time and my brother-in-law too. And then about 10 years ago, we realized that, hey, we each actually wanted to run our own company. And so we decided to make a transition and it worked out great and we get along very, very well and he wasn't forced to stay and it all turned out for the best. And I love my sister, love my brother-in-law too, and everybody can follow their own dreams and don't be shackled to the idea of this family legacy somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dave, it's been fascinating. Just thanks for taking us on that journey, just in culture and transitioning and innovation. It's fascinating. I could probably chat for a lot longer, but maybe we'll have to save that for another time.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for coming to the studio.